the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English debt.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, second hour, on this Saturday, October 17th, 2015. Telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
So we have really discussed what happens if you pay off a Ginnie Mae mortgage.
Right.
Which, by the way, Ginnie Mae is Government National Mortgage Association. Fannie Mae is Federal
National
Mortgage Association. And Freddie Mac is...
You're going to remember it?
I can't remember it. But it's something like Federal National Mortgage Corporation. And the reason that there's Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae is because Congress attempted in the 1980s to privatize them. They only got halfway there. And in the process, they set up two of them so they could compete with each other, which didn't work. Like it or not. You know, it's funny. It's one of the funny things. I say funny. There's this delicate balance that we have here in the United States between some things that are so purely socialist that they're just socialist.
It's Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation.
Oh, the Federal Home Loan. Oh, how did they get Freddie Mac out of that? I don't know.
Because this is a corporation. They already had Fannie Mae and they already had Ginnie Mae, and they needed to have a cute and friendly term for the large government organization, which would hold lots of money.
But in the United States, we have this rather peculiar balance between socialism and capitalism. And I know that a lot of people, particularly on the right side of the political spectrum, are rooting really hard for some form of return to pure capitalism.
Well, a lot of people on the left side are rooting really hard for some form of communism. So,
well,
it's not a good balance.
I don't know of anybody on the left currently. Really?
Yeah.
There are not very many.
Well, if you ask, did you watch the Democratic debates?
I did.
Bernie Sanders is right on the edge of socialism.
No. Well, what I'm trying to say is we're about half socialist, half capitalist already.
Right.
And everybody that's in the debates, including Donald Trump, simply wants to tweak the system a tiny little bit, and it creates outrage and yelling and screaming. But let me give you an example. Social Security.
What's the first word in that?
Socialist.
Oh,
Medicare.
Socialist.
Social Security and Medicare. No matter how far to the right a candidate is, they do not advocate getting rid of the two biggest socialist programs in the United States,
right.
Social Security and Medicare.
I'm a strong, staunch capitalist. I'm going to get rid of Social Security. Oh, don't kill me. Stop killing me.
Yeah,
ow!
So that isn't going to happen.
No.
But interestingly enough, many of the far right, relatively far right politicians and members of Congress, I noticed something, who are adamantly capitalist and want to get the government out of our affairs, have their health care on a single-payer government plan.
TRICARE.
And they have, I don't know if Congress has that, but they...
No, but others but that they, also feel that way.
They're under Medicare, and they take their Social Security paycheck, which means they don't really want to get rid of socialism.
No.
They just want to make a lot of noise.
Just want less socialism to be leached into the system.
And then we have...
So what we have already is fine. But not just
one
no
of the,
more.
The, one of the single, probably historically, the single biggest mover of the economy out there in the free enterprise side of the economy is residential home building.
Yeah.
And it is totally, at present, I say totally, it is 99%, and I would say that's conservative, funded by a socialist system owned by the federal government.
Yeah.
And yet, interestingly enough, there are people who are in the middle of that business who really, really want the government to shift violently to the right and get out of that. And I think one of the strangest things is if you really carefully look at their views, including the Koch brothers, there are some things they are not against, and it is those aspects, those socialist aspects of the government that cause them to make more money.
Right. And if you kind of take a step back and look at our economy as a whole, and we say, all right, which parts of it are the big drivers of growth? You would say education. At least through elementary and into secondary school, that's pretty much all government funded.
Our free enterprise system assumes we can hire literate, capable people.
Okay. And then you go to college, and the loans are subsidized by the federal government.
Right.
And if you look at, for instance, the medical program.
And every school district in the United States receives federal government funding.
Right. Medicare pays the vast majority of the post-schooling when they're actually on the rounds in the hospitals.
For doctors. Right.
And so if you look back, okay, so now that's one of the big growth factors in our economy, and that kind of grew out of the GI Bill because we had this big boom after the war when we educated a lot of people. That can go too far. We also subsidize loans to buy houses. And those are two of the biggest long-term growth factors to the United States. And it's easy to go too far in either one of those directions. Right now, without competition in those subsidized areas, we have real problems. So the government, for whatever reason, for good or bad, thinks that banks should not be relied on completely to have the best interest of the country involved when they're making the loans. They want immediate profit. Well, that's what banks do. And if we look long-term and we say, all right, a bank wants an immediate profit, that means if they make a loan and then they turn around and sell that loan on to somebody else and they make their money, that's what we had happening in 2007 and 2008 that caused the fiasco. Mm-hmm. We have the same sort of thing happening right now in student loans. It's a problem. The student loans, as long as the colleges recognize that anybody can get a student loan, they don't have to compete with each other on cost because you can come up with the money. And if you don't come up with the money, then you don't come to the school. Well, everybody that gets accepted can come up with the money as they just are now indebted for the rest of their life or a very large percentage of it. So we've gone too far in that direction. We need to look at other methods of accreditation and where that loan money can be used appropriately.
Well, I think there's a good argument from that, very frankly, that the Germans have got it right and we don't.
Well, we kind of designed the German education system.
And for those of you who don't know this, if you do well in the equivalent of middle school in Germany, in the ninth grade, there's tests. Now, the students and the parents hate those tests with a passion, but at the end of the ninth grade, there are a series of tests that students take, and it determines where they go from there, and there's actually three routes forward from there. And by the way, their choices are considered in this. But there is a group that goes on to a trade. In other words, they actually go out and start apprenticing to do something that needs to be done in the economy, maybe in a butcher shop or in
electrician
somewhere. Something where you do need technical skills, you do need a degree of education, but the skills are mainly learned on the job. The second group goes to the equivalent of what they call college, which is similar to what we call Texas State Technical College, TSTC.
Right. It's a tech school.
Where they will go for the three years of high school plus maybe one more year learning to be technicians, medical technicians, jet engine technicians, whatever. And then a minority, about a third of the students who do well on the tests, go into what we consider to be high school, the 3 years of what we would consider to be high school, which is really preparatory for
university.
For a university higher education. And practically none of those who go to that 3 years of what we would call high school stop there. They go on for at least a four-year degree. And they get, now this is an interesting point too, we've copied a little of that because in their high school, in the 3 years of high school, they get the equivalent of 2 years of junior college. So when they move on to university, they generally only have 2 years of study.
We have advanced placement, AP classes, yeah, that does this. It's the same thing. It's just it's applied across. We're trying to unify the whole schooling system into one building instead of separating.
They have two more years, and they get a bachelor's degree, and then a certain percentage go on to get a master's degree. But this is the point. It's all part of the public school system.
Right.
It's paid for out of taxes. And they're not paying, and this is the interesting thing, they're not paying any more for their system than we do for ours. And when I say for ours, if you wanted to, by the way, if you decide that your kid is really smart, even though he or she didn't do well on the tests, and you want him to go on to a private college and a private university,
you can do it.
You just have to pay for it like we do today. But for instance, in our case, in the case in Texas, what we would have is a situation where at the ninth grade, a person would go into either a trade, technical school, or college and college prep. They would spend 2 years then at the equivalent of the University of Texas, all taxpayer paid for. And they would have a bachelor's degree.
Now, that the result of that is that they have a well-educated population that's fitting the roles that they've chosen or that that society has chosen. Whether or not that's the best way to do it, it's what we thought was the best way to do it after we won World War II.
Right, and we basically set it up in Japan and Germany, and in both cases, their education system seemed to be working, very frankly, a lot better than ours because they don't saddle students with huge...
I would doubt that because they a statistic that you have stated several times is getting stronger and stronger. The university system in both Japan and Germany is horrible. Horrible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, they were very, very happy that one of their universities was in the top 100 in the world.
Oh, I don't question that.
Where the vast majority of the top 100 in the world colleges, universities, are in the United States and Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So we're paying for it, so we're getting something, but the way we're doing it, maybe we shouldn't go quite as far as Germany did.
Well, it's the people who have those great student loans, though, in many cases don't have an education that will enable them to get a job.
Except that, again, if you look at the statistics, if you look at the large numbers, if you have a degree that came from a four-year college, you're a lot less likely to be unemployed.
Sure.
The unemployment rate right now, 2.9% for college degree person.
I don't question that for a second, and I completely agree. I am of the opinion that the private side of our education system, for instance, the Red McCombs School of Business.
Right.
Would continue to do very, very well.
McCombs. They didn't have the red in there because they're orange. They can't have red and orange. That clashes. So it's
McCombs
School of Business.
Yeah, but this is definitely a red state, so it's okay.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Anyway, I think in all likelihood, this is my opinion, obviously, is that their private side of our higher education system would still work very, very well. We are evolving, by the way, slowly, towards that European system, in that a lot of people who go to get their degrees now are getting them through community colleges, which are very, very, very largely supported by taxpayer money. And if a student goes to a community college, their loan load coming out is comparatively minor.
Here's the problem with both systems, and this is a problem that is being both solved and caused by technology. The problem with both systems is that, one, money is freely available for anyone that wants it to go to college, either there or here. I mean, if you're going to go to the college and you're going to go through the thing, if you meet the test results, you can get it paid for. You may wind up with the government having debt long-term, or you may wind up with personal debt long-term, but you can do it. It's your choice what you get to study.
Mm-hmm.
What we can see, though, is that a lot of the professions that exist today won't exist in 15 years. Nurses won't have the same job description in 15 years that they do today, because we're getting robotics in the workplace. We're getting computers that are taking an active role in diagnosis and treatment. That's just the beginning, and the long-term implications of that are very, very clear. It's going to be a huge shift in how we work. And if people are going to work today after completing a 4-year degree to get a nursing degree and getting lots of student loans to do it, and they think this is going to be a career that's going to last me the rest of my life, they're going to be disappointed at some point when the world shifts, kind of like what happened to General Motors when a machine came in and replaced the person that was turning bolts. A machine can turn bolts a lot better, and eventually a machine will be able to give an injection or draw blood a lot better or check your vitals or... all of that comes back to, we don't have in place a flexibility in our school system to change with the times appropriately, because our accreditation system is very slow. And I've mentioned this university in the past. There's a place called Singularity University. It's worth looking up. It was founded by Ray Kurzweil and Mr. Diamandis, and it's an unaccredited university where they kind of expect you to have the beginning knowledge to get there, and in order to enter, you have to have a project that you want to work on. You have to have a business idea that you're working on, and it's the combination of a tech school, a business school, and some form of science-based school. And what you have at the end of it is a piece of paper that says that you went there, that is beginning to be more valuable than a degree from a major university. If we don't incorporate that concept into what we're doing across the board, this is one of the problems. Because it's not an accredited university, the loan money that you could get to go to Harvard isn't available to go to Singularity. Because it's a tech school, but it's really a university, but it's really a custom education program that's designed around a project that you come up with that they agree has good potential, and then they train you to do that project.
And, of course, the issue, though, is if you get a degree from someplace like that,
mm-hmm.
in order to get a job, and it's not an accredited school, in many cases they won't count it.
In order to get a job... where? Because Texas Instruments will hire you, Hewlett-Packard will hire you. Google is underwriting the program. They sit and they have job fairs. Google is a really, really hard place to get hired by.
Well,
and they are hiring actively from that job pool because they see people with innovative ideas that are interested in expanding the reach of human knowledge rather than just learning and going and doing. And, you know, the future is there.
Well, maybe my information is outdated, but for example, if you wanted, to the best of my knowledge, if you want to get a job at Baylor Scott & White and you have a degree, but it's from a non-accredited source,
right.
You don't have a degree.
Except the people that go to Singularity don't want to go and get a job at Baylor Scott & White. They want to have someone from the company that they've made go and sell equipment to make the surgeries better at Baylor Scott & White.
Well, again.
So it's a different style.
Yeah, but I'm saying for the regular person who is in Central Texas who wants to get a college education so they can get a good job.
And that's
it's
the
one
point.
Thing to say to move to California where the cost of living just went through the stratosphere.
I'm not. Let's go back a second. What I'm trying to emphasize is that if you go to a university and you think I'm going to get a 4-year degree so that I can go out and get a job wherever I want to go and get a job.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not true because your degree is important to what job you choose.
Right.
Right. And that degree...
Why is it not important?
I said that's important.
Oh, okay. Important.
Because
okay.
You got to go and you've got a degree that's in line with what you want to go and do. Say you want to work at Scott & White. So
right.
You get a nursing degree.
Right.
Well, that's what I started with. That degree may get you a job right now, but what about 15 years from now? And if you're not thinking out like that, we're kind of falling back to that 1960s mentality where you get a degree, you go and work for one company, it's the same company for your entire life, In the medical world, that's been true. You have been able to go and get a degree and go work for a hospital and stay at the same hospital your entire life, or maybe go to one other hospital somewhere, or maybe move twice. There aren't that many other professions where you do that.
And I agree with you that in the high-tech world, it may be that if you go to an online non-accredited university and you get whatever they issue at the end, which is it a degree?
What they give you a piece of paper. And see, here's the point. We need to change the accreditation methodology because that particular school needs to have a different form of accreditation because the accreditation process right now is a decades-long process. I mean, just look at Central mm-hmm. Texas College and how long it took them to become a four-year university. When we've had need for universities, the fact that our college inflation rate is going up so fast, we don't have enough universities for the number of people that want to go to them.
Basically the guild system whereby
if you restrict
the number of seats, you can raise the price.
Right, and we've had people that abuse the system. We've got a lot of the private universities that were doing it online. It turns out they were doing it all wrong, and there have been a lot of scandals around that. So having some form of regulatory oversight that isn't created by the group that doesn't want more universities out there because any more universities mean they get paid less. I mean, the concept of tenure is one of those things. I've got friends that are professors and they have tenure, and basically they are unfireable. They don't have to do anything. Where else?
Yeah.
Where else?
There's a lot of places that have dropped tenure in. And one of the things about tenure that I miss, and I'd say I have never had it, but I say I miss it, is the ability to take a position counter to that of the administration of the university
right. And
say, no, what you're doing is wrong. What I want to do over here is right.
Right.
And you can't fire me if I've been here 10 years. Now, whether that's the best approach, I don't know. One of the, and I guess that leads into a lot of other things, but we probably need to do some commercials along the way. I want to, since we're on this area, I want to talk a little bit, if I could, when we come back, about the way the world has changed. But we told them we were going to scare them and tell them something to be afraid of, too.
We haven't really
told them anything to be afraid of.
We've
got to
scare these people. It's October.
Yeah. I mean, it is, and people like to be scared. We will come back, Lord willing, after these commercials and tell you that
scary
there
things.
Is something scary happening and it could be really interesting.
Yeah.
So we'll be back after these important words from Town Square sponsors. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here remain 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And, of course, that's assuming today is Saturday, October 17th, in which case the telephone numbers have changed, but the people aren't here if it's not Saturday 17th.
They have not changed. Yeah. Think about to say.
The telephone numbers have not changed to protect the innocent, but the innocent aren't here. Hey, I was going to tell you something that was a little scary. Nice little scenario. I don't know how it's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen.
That sounds scary enough.
Yeah. And this is not a political statement. Although it's going to sound like a political statement to some people, but it's not. Just take my word for this, okay? And listen for a second. There are about 40 people, I think technically 39 members of a caucus in the House of Representatives called the Freedom Caucus. They have apparently agreed quite sincerely that they are not going to allow the election of a speaker. And they, even though they're only about 10% of the members of the House, there's like 435 members, I think, in the House of Representatives. They have the swing vote between the Democrats and the Republicans, and they intend to not have leadership and to block a couple of things, one of which is raising of the debt ceiling. And I think it's important, first off, to recognize that raising the debt ceiling does not increase the debt of the United States. It simply says it authorizes the Treasury to borrow the money that Congress has already voted this year to spend. So the House of Representatives, which is where these spending bills have originated, in committees dominated by the same group of people, have passed bills this year, spending bills, that says the government should spend this much money. We didn't take in that much in revenues because our taxes aren't high enough to do that. Therefore, the government has to borrow money. But at this point, those members in the House have said, we're going to use that to hold the government hostage to some things we want to get done. Now, why do I mention that? Absent leadership going into November, and we may not have effective leadership of any kind in the House of Representatives because of the blocking of a speaker election, we are facing a situation sometime in early to mid-November when the government will simply not have the money to pay its bills. And there are members of the Freedom Caucus who have said, oh yeah, well, they can just pay certain bills. Unfortunately, the Treasury is not set up to do that. Its computer system is not set up to do that.
Yeah, the Treasury's been...
And it's very questionable
whether... The Treasury's only job is to spend money authorized by Congress.
Uh-huh. And Congress has passed a law saying they must spend the money. And there's really a serious question whether constitutionally Congress can say, well, we'll pay some bills and not pay the others. Now, I don't know, and I don't think anybody sincerely wants to put the United States in default. And that's literally what would happen if we didn't pay our bills. However, given the ongoing confusion in the House of Representatives where the majority, frankly, the majority party cannot agree with itself on how to get something done, we could get a default or a partial default in November. It's happened before. There have been members of the Freedom Caucus who have stated that they believe it would be good for the economy if we defaulted. And I think there's a number of them who sincerely believe that.
Let me address that a second.
There's
part of what they're saying that I fully agree with. The part of what they say that I agree with, the big part, is that we're spending too much money. Long term, we are spending too much money. It looks bad with Social Security, Medicare. Those are things that long term we're going to have to figure out some pretty serious solutions to, or we're going to be in a lot of trouble. The way to fix that is to not authorize the spending. Not to authorize the spending and then say, I don't want to pay it. And that's what they're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
Congress authorizes the spending. And in the past, what they did is they would say, with each bill, they would pass a separate bill for funding that bill, which allowed them to kind of balance their own checkbooks as they went along. So they would authorize bond purchases or bond releases by the U.S. government.
Local government does that now.
Right. So if your school district is about to build a stadium for their high school, then they say, all right, we're going to authorize a bond issue to correspond with the building so that we can pay for it. Well, over time, Congress said, well, this is too much. We're doing two bills when all we need to do is really say to the Treasury, here, let us know when you've run out of money from what we issue here. We're going to call it the debt ceiling. We're going to tell you to spend the money, and when you need us to pass another bill that will say, all right, we need some more money to pay for all the stuff that we're spending, we'll do it. And for many years, that worked very, very well. Well, then relatively recently, not that long back, Congress said, well, this is a great way to fight the administration. How they got to that point to say fighting the administration by not paying for the things that they authorized to pay for is a convoluted thing, and why the American public tends to blame Congress rather than the president when the government shuts down is because the president can suggest to Congress, I think we should pay for these things. But it's never taken. I mean, when was the last time the presidential budget has been passed? And it goes way, way back in the 60s.
Really?
I think it happened in the 60s. And so how is it that the American people are going to get upset at the president when the government shuts down because Congress can't decide what to pay for.
And I've been criticized by saying, why are you blaming the Republicans for this? They're conservatives. It's the president.
I'm blaming Congress. I don't care about the Republicans one way or another.
Well, it is.
They
it
can
is,
figure it out.
It happens to be a small caucus in the House of Representatives that is that's what I'm saying.
Right.
That is verbally stating, we will not compromise. We want to shut the government down. Now,
there are several small caucuses. One's on the way left side that's saying exactly the same thing.
Well, I'm not familiar with that one.
When the Democrats were in office and Pelosi was there, we had some threatening. Basically, whoever gets to be holding the entire House, their party disintegrates into fighting itself rather than fighting the opposition. And that's what we're seeing here.
And we got a caller on 773-1400 who hopefully has something to say about this. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, actually, I wanted to segue. Well, it's not really a segue. I wanted to ask your opinion about something I heard last week that I haven't heard twice. That's why I think it might just be an unsubstantiated rumor. It has to do with Russia and Syria and the Middle East.
One of the things I wanted to talk about.
Go ahead.
There was a significant oil find either in Israel or in Israel-controlled territory that they said was the largest reserve or capacity in the Middle East.
I haven't heard that.
No. There have been an ongoing series of people who read something in the Old Testament and concluded that somewhere in Israel there's the hugest oil capacity in the world in that volcanic rock somewhere, but so far no one's ever found it. Now, there is a relatively small deposit of oil that is relatively well known offshore from Israel. And I have heard that there are some companies who are interested in trying to exploit that, but that's pretty much it. Now, the Saudi Arabia in the Middle East by far has oil reserves that are so huge compared with anyone else's that there's just no comparison.
Right.
And Saudi Arabia is really a pretty big country. That's one of the reasons that they can have a lot of oil reserves.
There are some conspiracy-type sites that when you do a Google search, the top ones that pop up about the massive oil discovery in Israel, it was on a personal blog, a WordPress blog, that it was first mentioned.
Yep.
And when somebody's personal blog is telling you about an oil discovery, I follow oil news very regularly. I read about new discoveries. I watch tanker movement. That's the sort of thing I'm looking at. And there's not been a massive find in Israel. There's some oil there, but there's not a huge amount of oil. As far as the Syria issue, I wanted to touch on that.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'll listen.
Thanks. I do want to talk about Syria a little bit because people's memory of what's going on there is as bad as what's going on in Ukraine. They don't know, and it's getting really, really confusing. I'm going to try to simplify it, but the way to do it is to go back in time to when this all happened. The Arab Spring was sweeping across northern Africa, and Syria was in the middle of that. Arab Spring was just food costs got too high, and so the dictators of all of these different positions weren't able to provide free bread or subsidized bread. Or circuses. And without that, if you look at the traditions of this area of the world going back as far as we have history, you have government upheavals, and that's what we had. We had bread riots that turned into the Arab Spring, and the United States saw this through the lens of democracy. The Russians saw it through the lens of anarchy. The Chinese said, I don't know what's going on over there. So in Syria, we had a faction of people that were trying very hard to do what happened in Egypt, to have a peaceful protest movement. Assad fired into the crowd. The crowd started firing back. This is over multiple rallies until suddenly you had rebels and you had the regime. Right at this point, the regime released a lot of jihadists from their prisons to go and basically join in the rebellion to cause it to look really bad for the Westerners to want to support the rebels, because the rebels had jihadists in the middle of them. And so if we give them support, then we're giving support to the jihadists. It was a pretty good move by Assad. it didn't work immediately, but it would have worked if he was allowed to continue to use his chemical weapons. So he used chemical weapons. We said, hey, that's you don't cross that line. We're going to get involved. We're going to invade. Obama had a speech. Kerry went to the United Nations and said, this is our timeline. Here's when we're going to invade. And then the next day, Obama changed his mind.
Well, the Russians stepped in.
Right. The Russians said, we can negotiate a deal where the Assad regime gives up all its chemical weapons and you can come and inspect them.
Right.
The thing is, we haven't been able to inspect anything. But it put off the invasion. We said, all right, we're not going to do that. A year later, almost to the day, ISIS has been growing there, and it was founded pretty much by the jihadists that were let loose by Assad, who he intended to gas but wasn't able to gas them all, so because we would have invaded. So a year later, we start airstrikes because ISIS has formed. The Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, or Iraq and Syria, was the original name. It's also the Islamic State in Levant, which is the old term for it. So when the president says ISIL, that's what he's talking about. The Islamic State is what they call themselves now, because they think they're the caliphate.
Caliphate.
Right. The head of the caliphate, the caliph, was born in Tikrit, the same place that Saddam Hussein was born. Saddam claimed to be the caliph, and that was part of the reason why he invaded Kuwait. So this is the hometown of Salah ad-Din, and the hometown eventually go far enough back, and Mohammed's family moved there. So this is, you know,
it's a really cool place to be born.
It basically, you can be all the legends and you can be God reincarnated or whatever they want to call themselves. So ISIS is there. And the Kurds secede from Syria. They say, all right, we want our own spot. It's already kind of happened in Iraq. They're autonomous area. They're part of the government, but they're kind of recognized as part of the government, but on their own. Mm-hmm. The Kurds in Syria say, we want to do that too. Well, the Kurds in Iraq say, we'll lose our autonomy if we combine our states across the invisible line in the dirt over there. If we combine and say, you're part of us, so we're not going to do that. The Turks were very happy. They said, don't do that. The Turks don't like the Kurds. The Saudis don't like Assad. He's Shia. The Saudis start with Jordan and several other states there, start funding the rebels. The United States gets involved and funds some of the rebels. They start training them with the CIA. All this is going on. Then Russia gets involved, and Turkey gets involved. So Turkey is bombing the Kurds as well as ISIS. Russia is bombing mostly rebels and not ISIS. Saudi Arabia is bombing mostly...
They're not actually bombing.
They're not bombing. They're just providing support for the rebels who are attacking...
Not ISIS.
Not ISIS.
Right.
Although they're kind of...
You said you were going to simplify this?
Right. This is the simplified version.
It really comes down to the fact that there's a civil war going on in the Middle East.
And it's not going to end anytime soon.
You've got the Shia on one side and the Sunnis on the other. And we try to make it into something else.
We try to make it into democracy.
It is really Shia against Sunni. It is what happened in Europe in the 1600s.
Right.
And Islam is about as old as Christianity was at that time. And they're having a big civil war like we had one in the 1860s.
Right.
And
part of that is due to the fact that oil prices have fluctuated so much.
It really comes down to the fact that communication costs have collapsed. And when communication costs collapse, nation states collapse with them.
Right.
All nation states are destabilized. Those with higher property rights generally tend to survive the destabilization. The United States has been destabilized too.
Yeah.
The fact that we can so quickly instantly communicate with Congress and express our desires
causes deadlock.
Causes extremism to appear and a destabilization in the United States. It's causing it in Europe. This instantaneous communication across the world is creating huge instabilities. And we're going to see a lot more of it. It isn't going to get better.
That's why we need to work on our flexibility.
The tribal boundaries are going to split. That in Syria, you know, we look at Syria, Iraq, Iran, we look at these countries
Kuwait.
In the Middle East, and we say these are countries just like there's countries in Europe and there's countries in the United States as a country. But the point is, they were artificial lines literally drawn in the sand.
They're just straight lines.
That were drawn by colonial powers. They didn't take into account that they cut directly across tribal regions, and they put half of a tribe in one country and the other half in the other country.
We had another thing.
And then mixed together tribes within a single country that hate each other with a passion, both religiously and ethnically.
We had a similar situation when the colonial powers left India. India was a very large, large country that is now two countries, Pakistan and India. Three countries, if you really want to count.
Bangladesh.
Bangladesh is there, too. And four, possibly, in that Kashmir isn't really either country. So if you look at the borders between India and Pakistan, nobody agrees on where they are. That there is no spot where you say this is where the border is. Well, there may be, but somebody else will say, no, it isn't. It's over here.
There is one spot they agree on. It's a gate.
Right, that one gate. They stand and they do ceremonies rigorously at
really,
each other.
Really, really proud, and both sides paint their line on the ground there and agree that's the border.
Right.
And we don't cross it.
If you look at Korea, you got the same thing, where the border is sort of there because the demilitarized zone is there, but it's somewhere in the middle of the demilitarized zone, and they're not sure what, and what's more, they really don't agree on where the maritime boundaries are. That's why things keep blowing up over there. That's the concept that is the historical norm for the whole world. And Western Europe and then the United States started imposing this concept of, we've all agreed this is where my land ends and yours started, because we have a bunch of people that go around and measure the land. They have survey equipment, and they stand up and they do these things, and that means with this survey and a piece of paper, I own this land.
We do have a convenient ocean on either side of
That's
us.
That's true.
Develops. And we
had to keep spreading until we reached it.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, again, to put this in historical context, the United States and Mexico had some rather pointed disagreements as to where our border was in the 1800s.
Yes.
And we had
very pointed.
We had several wars over that issue, and with each war, the border got further into what we
used
now
to be Mexico.
Used to be Mexico. And believe it or not, there's people in Mexico who still remember that quite well.
Right.
And just remember that New Mexico used to be Old Mexico.
Yes.
And
so did Texas and big chunks of California.
It puts it a little bit in context to realize that in the 19th century, we went through the same upheavals that you see going on in the Middle East right now. And the French and the British tried to get involved on several occasions and got their hands burned and got out.
Yeah.
And that was probably a really smart thing to do. I don't know. Obviously, when you have the ability to bomb the United States from the Middle East,
yeah,
or Southwest
we,
Asia,
we would probably be upset about that and do something
but
about
that's where
it.
We are. And, mm-hmm. and the point is to keep radical, or proper, in my opinion, strategic position is very simple. Keep any radical force weak enough, they are unlikely to be able to organize as Al-Qaeda did and attack the
all
United
you have
States.
To do is have them keep fighting each other.
Well,
and that's what's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, there's still a huge danger to us if one side comes out stronger, and that's an issue.
I want to inject one more thing in here, though, and that is, again, looking at history, we are in many ways in the thralls of World War I. We, the United States, are taking the position very much that the British wound up with.
Right.
The German position is largely Russia. And what happened in World War I is a proxy war was going on in a very unstable part of the world where there was tribal warfare going on.
Nobody knew who they were supporting or why, and they all thought
right.
they had a different reason for being there.
The point is that now the Russians, as of yesterday, officially have an armored battalion, an armored infantry battalion on the ground. They're bringing more in. Their aircraft are in the air. Turkey just shot down a drone that's almost certainly Russian.
Yeah.
Russian aircraft have locked weapons on Turkey's air. On air
they,
say,
they've
Turkey
violated
is NATO.
Airspace, and NATO means we have
Turkey,
to defend
right.
them.
And so there is a real potential right now that the United States and either a NATO ally or the United States itself and on one side and Russia on the other side could wind up in an armed confrontation that, for better or worse, because nobody really thinks it could happen,
could happen.
Could devolve into a major war. The similarities between right now and the buildup to World War One are pretty astonishing. So,
with us being Britain in World War One, and the Russians being Germany in World War One,
the British controlled the oceans all the way around the world at the beginning of World War One,
like we do now.
The Germans were an upstart power with some seafaring capability,
like the Russians are now,
and basically decided that they wanted to exercise their strength to prove they were not subordinate. They had taken over portions of a couple of other countries and gotten away with it, which is exactly
something
what Russia's the Russians
done.
Have done. You want something to be a little concerned about, there's something to be concerned about. And for whatever it's worth, the way we got out of a economic slump was to have a war. And
it's probably
we're in
not
an
the,
economic slump.
Not the recommended way of doing it.
But it's the way we traditionally do it. We go into austerity, just as the Europeans have gone into austerity. We're trying to force austerity on ourselves in the United States. Mm-hmm. We're cutting our militaries across the world in the name of austerity.
Except if you live in Russia.
And the end result, I mean, we're following the pattern that led up to World War One so amazingly. It's called The Guns of August is the book if you want to read it.
The two countries with the largest growth in military expenditures in the world, and you can throw in the third too. I'll throw in all three. The largest growth in expenditures, as in they are increasing as a percentage of their GDP,
right,
are Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Iran. They, while the rest of the world is trimming, are adding. And I wonder why.
Well, all I got to say is it's a very interesting world that we live in, and it is certainly challenging at this point. From an investing point of view, I know this is going to sound really weird, but this is really a good time.
Yeah.
Because of the pessimism and uncertainty, markets are relatively low.
Right.
And all I've got to say to anybody is it's time to just keep paddling and regularly give thanks that you live in the United States of America and you don't live in Europe or Southwest Asia or someplace like that, or Africa.
East or Africa or almost anywhere else in the world.
And we're running all these experiments and this one's working. But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we're out of time for this week. And if you'd like to call us, we have a telephone number off the air, 947-1111, or
you can reach that toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us directly at jeff at tpwc.com or jake at tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
Balance, your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.